There's a chance that I misunderstood your question. I'm going to give you an answer. It may be the wrong answer, and you're allowed to ask it again. In the case of a guy, say, for instance, putting up a fan dipole where it's operating on many frequencies, and he's making a poor man's balance by coiling up the coax, the most severe band is the lowest frequency band. If it's an 80 through 10 meter fan dipole, then you size the coil to have enough inductive reactance to act like an RF choke at 80 meters. And after that, because the inductive reactance goes up every time you double the frequency, you double the reactance, you're looking for something like 700 ohms or 1500 ohms of inductive reactance on your lowest frequency. When you go up to the highest frequencies, you get higher and higher inductive reactance, you get more and more choking action, and everything's hunky-dory. I'm a little bit afraid, though, I may have misunderstood, so if I did, you're allowed to ask again. K2TGW, K2RAW, go ahead, Les.
Okay, again, it's a simple 40-meter dipole outside. I am using a balun. I also put a second leg for 10 meters. They were cut for the right frequency, and believe it or not, on 10, 15, and 20, 10, 15, and 40, I do not need a tuner. Now, if I wanted to add a 20-line leg, or legs, one on each side, how do they have to be in reference to the other two? Or does that make any difference? No, I had no really intention of intertwining them, but, you know, can they just lay next to each other? Must they be in different directions or whatever? I have made a number of these before, but they always separate all the legs out. Now I can't because they're going to be up against the side of the house. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, you're going to have to forgive me. I'm a VHF, UHF person, not an HF person. When you say the word leg, does that mean it's a like a fan dipole, or does that mean another set of dipoles at right angles to the first one? You'll have to give me some words as to what the word leg means. It could be another trap that's added to the antenna so that another frequency range is capable. It could be another piece of wire that comes off at a different vertical angle or a different azimuth angle. So what does the word leg mean in that case, Les? You got it, Les. Wait for the beep, K2LIW.
No, it is a fan dipole. Right now there were two lengths, 9 feet something, I guess, for the 10-meter side, and 30-some-odd feet on each leg for the 40-meter side. So if I added another one for the 20-meter, that's my question. The leg meaning each side of the dipole. Sorry about the misuse of words.
Oh, you're using the words correctly. It's just that I didn't have a clear enough vocabulary there. When you add extra legs to a fan dipole-like structure, as you go up in frequency, the already existing legs almost do not see them at all. Transparent as all hell. If I had a 20-meter dipole, and I add a 15-meter leg to make it a fan 20, 15-meter dipole assembly, as I add the 15, it would take very precise laboratory equipment making measurements on the 20-meter dipole to see that there's some kind of a change because I added the 15. When you go up in frequency, you can get away with murder. You get a little, life's a lot more complicated when you're going down. If it was a 10-meter dipole, and now I add a 15-meter leg to it, I'm going down in frequency, yes, the 10-meter dipole is going to see a lot of extra capacitance, a significant amount of retuning might be required if you're a serious guy looking at the standing wave ratio meter. So as long as you're going up, I think you've got it made, Les. You'd be amazed how transparent things are. By the same token, if you and I were operating your fan dipole from a tower, and you wanted to add some guy wires to the tower to make sure it's nice and strong, and all of your buddies will tell you you got to add a zillion egg insulators to the guy wires to make sure they're not interfering with the pattern. As long as those wires do not hit resonance at your particular frequency, you would be amazed how transparent they are. And these guys that go through all that extra jazz of a Philly strand and extra egg insulators, let me drop. 99% of the time, it is not required. And even if your particular guy wire just happened to be the magic length that hit resonance, The next thing a guy would do is start putting in egg insulators and whatever. You don't have to do that. Simply put a connect a piece of wire to the guy wire somewhere in the middle and bring it off at some other crazy angle. That, as a capacitive hat, so to speak, will change the resonance and stop it, and you go back to transparent. So unless the antenna, unless the new structure is resonant on the old frequency, it's not there. It's transparent as all hell. By the same token, those LIPA power lines across the street from you at the exact same altitude as your dipole, and they're in the direction of Europe, and you want to talk to Europe, and you think they're going to stop the signal from going there. They're extremely transparent. They may give you some electromagnetic interference if there's some arcing, but for them to cancel your signal, almost not. So I think you've got it made, but when you do this and you make the measurements, please come back and tell us what you find, because once in a while we're wrong here, Les. K2TGW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, at present I have a 1040, and it's, with a tuner I can do anything from 40 through 10 meters, so I have no problem. And, of course, a good 40-meter tuned dipole is great for 15. All right, thank you, Dick. You sort of enforced what I thought I knew, but you never know what you don't know because you don't know because you don't know. 7-3, and a happy, healthy New Year.
WB2OMW.
Mr. OMW. If it's on this particular subject, start it with your name and give us the information, sir.
It's Rob. It's a different subject when you're ready.
Okay. We'll put you on the list. The next person on the list is Jim, who's had to wait an awful long time. And we're keeping him up late. Kilo Delta 2. Mike, here we go. Bravo Hotel Yankee. And I think he's had his license like 2.5 weeks. Go right ahead, Jim. K2RIW in a second. I'll answer anything except decibels. Hope you're not going to ask me about decibels. I'm having some fun with him. Go ahead, Jim.
No, don't worry about it. I was thinking about it, but I decided against it. I was actually going to ask about, it's kind of a weird question, but I've been looking at HF because I'm studying for my general, and I haven't really sat down and studied yet, but that's what I was going to do tonight, but then I realized the TechNet was here. So I'm going to do that tomorrow. I see on my little ICOM thing I got at HRU, and I just got an antenna. The antenna that the guy at the antenna sent me. But anyway, I'm looking at the HF band plan, and I see 160 meters. What goes on at 160 meters?
There's some really serious guys down there, Jim. I say down there because I think in frequency, and it's a lower frequency. Those guys brag about the fact that they are top banders. In other words, they think in wavelengths. 160 meters is the longest wavelength of all the popular ham bands. So from their point of view, they're top banders. At 160 meters, just like every other one of the ham bands, what's the maximum usable frequency? What's the state of the sunspot cycle? How much D-layer absorption are you getting? Where is the sun? Where is the terminator? What direction am I getting the longest propagation today? Am I getting a pure vertical incident sky wave? In other words, is the signal coming out of my antenna going straight up to the ionosphere and bouncing back down and giving me short range? Am I getting extended that ground range? You can, as you study the propagation and the characteristics of each band, they've all got their idiosyncrasies, they've all got their individual ways of behaving. But from one point of view, it's a normal ham band. It's got guys on Morse code, it's got guys on single sideband. I think it's probably got some guys experimenting with some of the digital modes. I'm not positive about that. So it is a ham band. Let me drop. That gives some of those guys a degree of exclusivity. In other words, because a resonant half-wave dipole down there is around 263 feet long. It has a degree of exclusivity. For a guy who really wants to put up a full half-wave dipole, he needs a heck of a lot more property. If he's not smart enough to know there's ways he can electronically shrink the antenna, zigzag it in various ways, and put loading coils you could force a 160-meter antenna onto a very small piece of property if you're smart enough. But a lot of people don't know that. A lot of rigs don't go down to 160. So it's a kind of an exclusive club because not all the rigs go there. Not all the people have enough property to think they can put up a good antenna and so on. So it's a good band. It's not quite as popular as 80 through 20 meters, for instance. But you'll find a good group of people there. They tend to be the old-timers talking to each other about the good old days. I say that with prejudice. I don't know. I haven't really been there. I think that's true. The people I know who are on 160 meters happen to be the older hams, but it could be just a particular cross-section of guys I ran into. If you've got a receiver that goes there, any old hunk of wire you hang on to the receiver will allow you to listen. You won't be able to transmit through it, but you'll be able to listen and decide whether or not things are going on there. I know that also on a slightly different subject, let me drop. I know that when you talk to, I forget who it was now, earlier in the week. can't think of the guy's call letters right now. N2, he told you about the meteor scatter, the meteor shower. And when you listen on 2 meters, for instance, for meteors, it takes slightly more specialized equipment. Most of the guys listening to meteors on 2 meters are using Yagi antennas, aiming them in very specific directions, and the amount of echo you get from a meteor trail is a function of 1 over frequency to either the second power or the third power. I forget which it is. In other words, as you go higher and higher in frequency, the length of the ping, as they call it, that you get out of the meteor becomes shorter and shorter. A typical meteor burst on 2 meters, if you did an average of a whole lot of them, I think the average would be about 1.5 seconds long, maybe 2 seconds long. Occasionally you get a real big blue whizzer, as they call it, which lasts for 30 seconds. That's very rare. The majority of the meteors on 2 meters are very brief. On 6 meters, they're a hell of a lot longer. On 10 meters, they're longer yet. So to know what to listen for is another factor. I think you did stay up and did some listening, and there's a chance you didn't hear anything. With your method of listening, don't be discouraged. KD2BHY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, thanks. I have another very short question. Are there any, like, unusual ham bands that aren't listed, like, usually? Like, from 160 meters to 23 centimeters? Is there anything, like, beyond that or in between?
If a person was born in New York State and said, are there people in any other state? You and I would laugh at them. If a person is born in the United States and said, are there any other countries? Of course, we would laugh at him. To a guy who's on 80 through 10 meters, and you're talking to a guy who has been me, I have spent a number of years of my life on the 10,000 meg ham band, the 3 centimeter, 47 gigahertz, 74 gigahertz, 120 gigahertz, 240 gigahertz, and all above 300 gigahertz. There are a small percentage of very serious guys pursuing those super high frequencies. In the old days, everyone used to believe those super high frequencies were only good for line of sight. These guys are finding this brand new modes of propagation up there when you create the right kind of equipment. I have talked to people in 10 separate states on single sideband, on the 10 megacycle, on the 10 gigahertz ham band, using 1/4 of 1 watt of power into a 2-foot dish on 100 feet of tower. 1/4 of a watt, purely solid-state transmitter. I've talked to people in 10 states. My best DX is something like 340 miles, even though my radio horizon is only 40 miles away. Are there upper ham bands? Are there people anywhere else in the world, Jim? You can see what I'm saying. The fact that you don't hear about it, the fact that it's kind of rare. Let me drop one more time. It's another very exclusive club. There's one human being per 500 in the general population as a ham radio operator. There is one ham per 500, roughly. that are pursuing the frequencies above 2,000 megacycles. So you could say there's something like 5 guys per million in the general population that are pursuing these upper frequencies. It makes them pretty rare individuals, but they've got a very tightly knit group. There's something called the Microwave Reflector. It's kind of a website where these guys sign into every single day, transmit information back and forth to each other. There's about 400 guys that are a member of that group in about 15 different countries. They get together twice a year in various places, like the Microwave Update, which this year is going to be held in California. There's also the Microwave Roundtable that's held in London, and so on. These guys will come from all these countries and get together for 3 solid days and talk about their favorite super high microwave frequencies. So it's another exclusive club that you don't hear about unless you know to ask for it. Apparently you know to ask about it. KD2BHY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, thanks. That was just because I saw a band playing on the internet, and they had, like, anything above so-and-so frequency is amateur, and I was just kind of a bit puzzled. So hopefully I'll have my general thing. KDTDHY, back to next.
You know, with anything beyond a technician license, you're allowed to use all those super high frequencies. So the kind of exclusivity areas you have on HF, in other words, there are certain areas on the 80-meter band where you're only allowed to use it if you have an advanced or an extra class license. There's very little about on that on the upper frequencies. On those upper frequencies, with a tech license, you're allowed to go anywhere and do anything. And those upper frequencies, people use slow scan television, fast scan television, radio teletype, meteor scatter, moon bounce. I'm trying to think of some of the crazy modes that they use. Some of the digital modes, the weak signal Joe Taylor, WSJT modes, allows them to listen to signals that are extremely weak, bouncing it off meteors, bouncing it off the moon, bouncing it off airplanes, bouncing it off buildings and mountains. So those upper frequencies where you get very high gain antennas, where the signal coming out of there, if you could see it, looks like a flashlight beam, and you aim the flashlight in the right direction and bounce the signal off the object and transmit signals a hell of a lot longer range. On the 10 gig band, for instance, one of the things you can do is called rain scatter. If there's a rain cloud between you and the guy you want to talk to, and you both aim at the rain cloud, you get a huge reflected signal on 10 gigs off of the rain cloud. You don't get that on the lower frequencies. A whole lot of complicated reasons. So as you can see, when you go to these higher frequencies, you find some brand new modes of propagation. Who would ever think that rain and snow particles would be good reflectors? Well, when you're high enough in frequency, where the wavelength is short enough, and therefore that great big water drop is big enough to start acting like a reflector, it does. Alrighty, I think Bob was the next person. WB2OMW. Go right ahead with your question, Bob. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Ned.
WB2OMW.
Had trouble with the alarm system today, generated by about 500 watts from the amplifier on the upper part of 80 meters, around 3.9. So I'm wondering if there's a quick and dirty solution I can use, perhaps putting ferrite cores around leads into the box. It's not a big panel. It's one of the smaller panels.
Yeah, that kind of electromagnetic interference. Start off knowing that it's not going to be super easy most of the time, Bob. The chain is no stronger than the weakest link. In other words, if you could do some kind of a thoroughly objective study, and you find out each one of the sensing wires to your alarm system and each one of the reporting wires and the power supply wires, if you could find the one that has the strongest interference susceptibility, and you thoroughly eliminate the susceptibility of that wire. In other words, that wire is picking up a whopping big signal, and you shield and bypass and make that wire perfect.
Coming.
You do that, and all of a sudden, nothing happens. You still have the problem. Then you go to the second strongest signal and do the same thing. until you eliminate every one of them, the problem is not going to go away. And how do you find which one is the most susceptible? And I guess the various experiments by slowly sneaking up on it, by slowly increasing the power and find out where it happens, and experimenting with each one of those wires, maybe unplugging one sensor at a time and so on. It's not easy. Let's see, maybe Wes has already had interference with his alarm system. Maybe he's got a simpler solution. N2XJN, K2RAW. Go ahead, Wes.
Intuition. The answer is very simple. Each of the zone is an open loop that reacts on closure. Usually there is a 2 kilo ohm resistor or 1 kilo ohm resistor depending from the panel that is in series with the zone. These zones are typical logic TTL protected, so those zones will never create a problem. Now, the only problem that you have is a keypad. You have a 4 screw for the keypad, and two of them, some 4 wires goes to the keypad. And it's a remote box that is communicating in digital code. 2 wires is for the power, 2 wires is for the data. Now, data, as we know, is a TTL square wave. Let me jump. What you got to do is replace the wire for the keypad and put a shielded one. Ground the shield to the ground. That's it. You don't have any more problems. Now, let me go for the wireless. And to XGN.
No wireless on the system. It's all hardwire. And actually,
One more thing. If you have a zone expander, let's say the system is made for 8 zones or 6 zones, and then you have a system for another 8 zones. And the zone expander, unless you have a zone doubling doesn't create any problems. It is simply double resistor that is in series with which one of the zones. Don't utilize 2 screws, which is ground and the zone, that is on number 1. And it reacts as a simple voltage bridge, voltage divider, which actually is sensing the zones. But if you have a zone expander that is connected to the keypad, and then it expands to another 8 zones, you would know if you have more than 8 zones about it. Let me jump. And also, it's good to know if your alarm system is Ademco, Radionics, Honeywell, FBI, or NAPCO. Now, that zone expander is mostly connected to the keypad, and data is going to that board, and then it expands to another zone. In the same old systems of Honeywell right now, which was formerly Ademco or Pitway Corporation branch, they have used the 2 last screws of the system next to the 4 screws for the telephone, and there was a data for 2 wires zone expander. That is supposed to be also shielded, unless the zone expander is mounted inside the box. Send to XGN.
Have any further questions on this, Rob? As I see it, it's going to take a slow process of elimination, unplugging things and whatever. Wes made it sound like he's fairly sure that the most susceptible object is the keypad. Lots of shielding is required. And if your system will continue to operate with the keypad unplugged at the main box, that would be an extremely interesting experiment to unplug the keypad and see if the interference is still there. It's going to take quite a bit of testing. I know Wes feels it's simple, and in his case, maybe it was, and maybe because he's installed quite a few of these systems, he's learned the tricks of the trade. But if you don't get immediate success, it's not because you're unlucky. There are times with what you're trying to do could be a little bit difficult, particularly if you're kilowatt of 80 meters is coming out of an antenna that's only a small number of feet away from the various sensors and portions of that alarm system. Eliminating it could be not so easy, in my opinion. I've heard guys go through quite a bit of work before they finally found the solution. Back to you, Bob. That'd be B2OMW. And let us know what you find out. K2RIW and the Tech Man.
N2MB, I can probably help him out with that.
Yes. Okay. I know. Which way did I come in? Let me get the beeps.
Yeah, Barry has installed quite a few alarm systems. I guarantee he's been there. Let's see what Barry's got to say. Hold on a little bit there, Bob. N2 Moonbounce, K2RIW. Go ahead, Barry.
Ringer detector.
Okay, Bob. If you want, I'll give you my phone number, and you can call me. That might be a big help to you, because we could discuss this further without burdening the entire net with it. But first you have to find out what kind of a problem you're having. When you're transmitting on, you said 75 meters, is the alarm showing a zone fault? Is the problem possibly coming into the phone line? Do you have it? I assume you might have it on central station. Maybe you don't. So you got to give me some particulars. And if you want, I'll give you my phone number right now. I don't have a problem with it. It's a business line anyway. And you can explain it more fully to me. There are places you can put chokes to stop the RF. But probably if you think it's in a zone, the best thing to do is to disconnect the zones. Be careful. You may put them back in the right place, by the way. Label them. Disconnect them, see if the problem goes away. If you have all the zones off and you still have the problem, then you know for sure it's coming in from the phone line or the power line or something like that. N2MB.
Sure. I'll be happy to take your phone number. I believe your name is Barry. Briefly, it's the RF is triggering the fire alarm, which is showing up on the panel. And it is central station.
Okay, it's sending a signal to central station. It's picking up a... Okay. You can do a lot of things to get rid of that problem. You can put chokes in that fire. Those are usually typically four wires. Are you using two-wire smoke detectors or four-wire? First of all, we've got to answer that one.
It's two-wire. And the system was installed by Slomitz.
Okay, I think typically they use a Demco or something. All right, then you got to get these big chokes. They have to operate. They have to work at 75 meters. You run the fire alarm wires through the chokes two or three times. They're pretty big chokes. And then back into the box, you know, that sort of thing. Anyway, let me give you my phone number. I can do it right now. It's 718-327-4952. 718-327-4952. And if you want, we could discuss this over the phone, you know, get down to the nitty-gritty of it. N2MB.
Okay, very good. Just verify your name was Barry.
Roger, it is correct.
Cool. I'm sure it still is Barry. Thanks, guys. That's information overload right now, but it's going along with what I was thinking. And running shielded wire to the keypad might be mission impossible because it goes through the walls. I suppose I could solder shielded wire onto the twisted pair and then pull it back. Hopefully it won't break. But a lot of good information. Thanks again. Back to net, WB2OMW.
And when you do enough testing, Bob, you might find out it's not the keypad that's false alarming the fire. It might be the twisted pair to the fire. The smoke detector itself is the particular antenna. It's got the right orientation, the right length of wire to pick up your particular frequency of signal. Barry? I vaguely remember hearing that phone number before. If I made a guess that you had the exact same phone number for 30 solid years, would I be close? N2 Moonbounce, K2RIW?
No, you wouldn't be close because we've had that number for over 60 years.
Yeah, to an engineer, that's just a 2-to-1 error. 60 years. Whoa. It sounds to me like you're going to stay a while. It sounds to me like you found a place, you found a home, Barry. Go ahead.
No, not really. You know how it is today with phone numbers. They follow you wherever you go. I just don't change the number, that's all.
Are you in the same QTH in Far Rockaway?
Yes, I am. And you know where it is, because you've been here.
Okay. To my knowledge, you were birthed, born in that particular house. So if I say you've been there a while, am I correct?
I think you could find my DNA in the paint.
Okay. I think you're going to stay a while. You're not one of these guys that hops all over the place. you're a person who finds a place and stays there. Alrighty. The next thing on our agenda, if Paul's available, is WS2N. And Paul, I see you haven't signed in tonight. I'm assuming you're there. The ARISS, A-R-I-S-S, at ARISSAT 1, which is a Soviet ham radio repeater, on July 4th, came into the atmosphere. And I wonder if you've seen that one, Paul. WS2N, if you're there, K2RIW.
WS2N. I haven't followed that one. I believe that was on ARRL. They posted that information on one of their weekly letters. But, okay, Dick. Didn't copy that. But I was wondering if you got my email in regard to that picture of the James Webb Space Telescope. First of all, Dick.
Boy, did I get that picture. Wow, is that a picture. It's a picture of all the people who worked on that program. I'm going to guess there's 100 people in that picture. They're standing on the lawn in front of what I'm guessing is a full-scale mock-up, full-size mock-up of the James Webb. It is a huge piece of hardware. It's got about 5 layers of shield. It looks to me like each one of those layers of the shield are about, if I had to make a guess, I'd say they're 30 feet from front to back and 20 feet left to right, and it's 5 of them parallel to the ground. And then this great big 18-section optical telescope, infrared telescope, sits on top. What a massive piece of hardware. Beautiful picture. So I know that that couldn't possibly be the piece of hardware that's going to go into space, because it would be in a clean room, it would be treated with tender loving care. That's got to be a full-scale mock-up. And so where would a person go if you weren't lucky enough to have a friendship with WS2N and had him ship that picture to you? Where would I go to see that picture, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
I guess I'd have to go to the James Webb website. You know, they have each individual spacecraft has their own website. So I don't remember if I got it there or not. This picture is about a year old, so they took that about a year or so ago, and that's been sitting on my computer for a long time. But that gives you an idea. I know I've talked about the size of the thing being the size of a jet plane, you know, like a 727 or something, but that really puts it into perspective. I've talked about the size of a tennis court or whatever, but when you put, you know, one time I counted like about 100 people or more standing below that space telescope, that mock-up, like you said, and that's about as good a perspective as you can get with this thing. Put this thing a million miles out. Yeah, the moon is a quarter of a million miles out, so 4 times that distance from Earth, and put this thing into operation and make sure it doesn't break because you can't service it. Now you know why it costs so much. Let me drop it. So, okay, very good, Dick. I would just search the website. I don't remember where I got it from. I'm on so many of those different websites. My guess is probably James Webb, put in James Webb Space Telescope home website. I'm sure you probably come up with it. So, yeah, okay. I thought I'd bring that up to your attention, Dick. A picture's worth a thousand words. One other thing I've been reading about, you know, we've got all these different spacecraft going up to the International Space Station. And there's, you know, a lot of talk about where's the next manned spacecraft coming from. Well, it's going to be probably from the United States, from the SpaceX group, the Dragon spacecraft being launched by the Falcon 9 rocket system by the same corporation. And about six people would be able to travel in that to the space station once it becomes manned. Right now it's going to be a cargo ship. Let me drop it. It'll just be a cargo ship similar to the Progress, except carry more weight than the Progress Russian spacecraft or the Japanese spacecraft. They have a spacecraft that goes up to the space station now, and then you have the ATV, the automatic transfer vehicle by the European Space Station. That probably carries about three times the amount of weight of the Progress ship. But none of them are manned, except eventually this Dragon will be manned. We have an Orion spacecraft that will be manned, but not really planning on going to the space station. That's supposed to go to deep space. But there's something that was launched back in March and one the previous year called the X-37B. Actually, done by the Air Force, and it was launched on an Atlas V rocket. Let me drop it. And it was really never advertised on the news that much. You know, you have to look for this thing. You have to almost know it was being launched before you knew about it. Well, the last one has been up there since March, and I guess another 6 months or so they'll bring it back. And this thing looks like the space shuttle. Very small, I mean, relative, to give you an idea, the whole thing would fit in the back of the cargo of this space shuttle. So it's small. Right now it's just you might call it a cargo vehicle, not planning on going to the space station. It's actually going to be used for the military, you know, it'll go up, it'll be able to put a satellite up in space, probably military, and then actually bring the whole satellite back, and this thing looks like the space shuttle. It could land on the ground, and eventually they're thinking about making this thing a little larger, almost twice the size, about 30 feet, which would mean maybe 60 feet long, and you'd be able to put up to six astronauts on board. I mean, I don't think it's, you know, it's just not going to happen anytime soon, but they're working on it. I mean, it kind of looks like a version of the space shuttle. It actually looks more like, it's called the X-37B. The manned version would be the X-37C. And if you Google that, you know, X-37B, you can see what I'm talking about. It looks like a takeoff of something that was canceled back about 10 years ago called the X-38. The X-38 was a spacecraft that looked like the space shuttle, and they were going to put it into the back of the cargo bay of the space shuttle, bring it up to the space station, and attach it permanently to the space station. I'd just leave it there for years. Drop it. WS2N. And in case there was an emergency, that one would have carried up to seven people. And you would have climbed into the spacecraft and disembarked, and it would have come back automatically, really without even a pilot necessary. And that's what this thing does, the X-37B. It goes up on the Atlas spacecraft and comes back autonomously and lands. And they've actually done this. Last year, 2010, they did it. And they sent it up. Like 6 months later or 8 months later, they actually brought it back and came back and landed. So it's an interesting thing. Right now, I mean, it has no windows. If they ever put a crew on board, they would actually have cameras, and you would look through your LCD screens in the inside the spacecraft to see how. So this is something that's out there, but not really talked about that much there. Back to you, WS2F.
The James Webb Space Telescope, going back one subject, Paul, is such a beautiful looking thing, such a huge piece of hardware. I think it's like around $2 billion worth in development right now. It's going to be launched, I think, fairly soon. It's such a beautiful looking thing when you see this full-scale mock-up that if a person goes to the James Webb site at NASA and is not able to find that photograph, there's not a great number of guys that are quite that enthusiastic, but there are a few that have got a real deep need for this kind of a picture. If somebody mailed you their email address, would you be able to ship them a copy of that picture, Paul? And roughly, you probably know the approximate weight and the approximate number of dollars of James Webb. When you see how big this piece of hardware is, and you try to picture how in the world are they going to fold all of that up. This thing is bigger than a tennis court, and it's probably 20 feet high. How in the world are they going to fold all of that up, put it inside of a launch vehicle that's going to be launched from probably the Kennedy Space Center, go into a parking orbit, then go into the transfer orbit where it goes out a million miles and folds itself and does everything just right. What an ambitious project. Wow. We got to keep our fingers crossed on this one, Paul, because there aren't two of them going out there. This is a one-shot deal, and it better work. So would a person be able to get that picture from you, Paul, if they mailed you their call letters? And if so, are you easy to find? Are you listed in QRZ.com? WS2N, KQRIW.
By the end of the net, I'll find that picture on the computer. I'll find it. In less than 15 minutes, I'm sure I'll find that. And then I'll tell you where to go. Because it's best that you do, because they have animation. They have animation of this thing opening up. It's really an incredible thing to watch. And sometimes I like to stop it, move it slowly, and see what part was next. It's one of those deals. How in the world could they do this? So yeah, the launch date, we got a long time. 28 Toyotas. a lot of weight. Let me look at the computer. I'm sure I'll find the website. It's six and a half meter wide there. Mirror. So roughly 21 feet. A little bit bigger than that. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, this mirror is made out of 18 individual hexagon-shaped mirrors. It's gold-plated because gold is a good reflector for infrared frequencies. This is an infrared, very high resolution, very high sensitivity infrared optical telescope. It's going to be way beyond what Hubble has ever done. And once you've got that kind of resolution at infrared frequencies, which can look through dust clouds and see the actual stars in the form in the process of forming, and see planets in the process of forming, see planets and stars coagulate out of a great big ball of dust. When I say a ball of dust, I'm talking about things that are, a million miles in diameter. And so during the birthing process, with optical telescope, you're not going to see much. With an infrared telescope, which penetrates the dust, you're going to watch it happening. You're going to watch the birth. So they're going to see some exciting things. I sure hope this thing works. 2018. So that is 6 years from now. And I think you said 14,000 pounds. Wow. The size of this thing, to squeeze that all into a launch vehicle and to have enough booster power on board, enough fuel to send it out a million miles. Wow. Ambitious project. Is that the... I made a rough guess that it's around $2 billion. Am I close up? Paul, go ahead.
Uh, I think it was up to 7 billion or something. I'll have to check on that. I remember a couple of months ago mentioning that it was probably around 7 billion.
Okay. I knew it was going to be expensive. Now, what's unique about the ARRL letter for the month, which tells you what happened with this Soviet-created spacecraft, a space satellite, ham radio satellite. It was launched from the International Space Station last August, which makes it, what, 5 months ago? And the thing has already re-entered the atmosphere on July 4th. Now, I know that when it was launched from the International Space Station, I'm going to make a rough guess, that it did not have any kind of a booster rocket for a whole lot of reasons. You take a ham radio built piece of hardware and you put that on a launch vehicle for the International Space Station. Guaranteed, they're not going to allow you to have any significant amount of pyrotechnics on board. There's no booster rocket on that thing. There's no Apogee kick motor. Yeah, the space shuttle has launched a few things that had a rocket motor on board, but they were NASA-created things that had a zillion safing techniques on the pyrotechnics during the launch. And so no amateur device has that. So therefore, the so-called launch from the International Space Station, I think, really means that an astronaut with a spacesuit on held the thing in his hand and let go of it. So therefore, it has essentially the exact same orbit, I am guessing, as the International Space Station. And this thing has come back into the atmosphere in, let me pick a number, 5 months. That leads me to believe that it gives you some idea as to what the International Space Station is being subjected to. It has a much higher mass-to-area ratio. Therefore, it has a lot longer time in orbit. But it must be boosted periodically to make sure it doesn't enter the atmosphere. The telemetry on board that spacecraft read up to 167 degrees Fahrenheit at the end of its mission as it was starting to hit the atmosphere and experiencing heating.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, during that atmospheric interface, when it started hitting the atmosphere, the last piece of telemetry they got out of it said that the temperature had gone to as high as 167 degrees, and that was the end of it. In other words, for all we know, the electronics couldn't bias itself correctly at those kind of temperatures anymore. So what little you know, Paul, do you think I'm correct in guessing that the so-called launch from the International Space Station really consisted of letting go of it? It really didn't have any kind of a booster rocket, I believe, because you wouldn't be allowed to put that on a launch vehicle. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick. Oh, yeah. There's only so much you can do. And give me about another minute. I want to make a tiny URL. I found a picture, but it's a long URL. Yeah, let me make a tiny URL out of it.
Okay, Paul, take your time and come back with that information. John, KC2WGB, tell us about the Dear John letters that you've gotten this week. I just thought of that one. I know, it ain't very funny. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB, good evening again, Tech, and everyone on the net. Got a couple of questions, so you're ready to go. I know we're going to revisit this one. I remember Mel talking about this with you. This is an antenna question. And this is coming from Steve in Alpine, New Jersey. His parents have a new car. He has an HT, which he uses at home. And he's working pretty successfully with an outdoor antenna. However, he wants to take it into his dad's car. And he needs a mag mount. He's worried about damaging the car. So he wants to know, should it be on the deck or the roof, and he wants to put a thin piece of Mylar between the mag mount and the car to prevent it from getting scratched. He'd like to know if there's any drawbacks to that, if the magnet will still work, and give him a little brief history and explain the capacitance coupling to him, possibly, and he'll be on his way. Over to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
I'm assuming this is a two-meter antenna, two-meter handy tip.
Yes, it is.
Could be two and could be 450. The answer is about the same. When you buy a good brand of mag mount antenna, they almost all come with a sheet of plastic on the bottom that goes in between the metal of the magnet and the automobile surface. So that sheet of plastic, as long as it's in good shape, does the protection you need. Now, if you want to be doubled on, sure, belt and suspenders, and you want to put another layer of plastic, you're welcome to do that. When it comes to the performance of the antenna, if you put it on the deck of the car, you'll get medium good performance. You get a lot more performance than you will with the rubber duck operated on the handy-talkie from inside the vehicle, any kind of an outside antenna. Outside of the metal structure of the car, it's going to give you a lot more performance. Let me drop. And with all VHF antennas, altitude is everything. So because the cab of the car, the passenger compartment, has the most amount of altitude, you'll get the most amount of performance there. Also, you'll get the most omnidirectional pattern. If you mounted it on the deck, you'll have a little bit stronger signal forward than you will rearward. The experiments that the IEEE Antennas and Propagation Society have done, they put full-size automobiles inside of an anechoic chamber and mounted VHF antennas in various locations. The net result is that the strongest signal is always in the direction of the mass center of the vehicle. Mount the antenna on the left lower on the rear left-hand bumper, and you'll get the strongest signal in the direction of the forward right-hand bumper, so to speak. So you'll get a more directional pattern if it's not on the peak of the car. In the center of the car, you'll get the most omnidirectional pattern. You'll get the higher performance. The antenna itself is using as a counterpoise the metal of the car. On 2 meters, the thin sheet of plastic that goes between the magnet and the sheet metal of the car gives you a rather strong amount of capacitance, quite a few picofarad, which means it's a rather small capacitive reactance at 146 megacycles. That really means that electronically, the base of the antenna really is almost connected to that metal, electronically. Mechanically, it's not. It's separated by some plastic, but electronically, it's connected there. And the design of the antenna is already tuned for that particular plastic. And if you have any doubt, if you've added your own additional piece of plastic and you want to know, have you detuned the antenna? A rather simple experiment, borrow somebody's 2-meter standing wave ratio bridge or antenna analyzer. Let me drop. And you set the handy-talkie into the transmit mode through the antenna analyzer or the impedance measure or the standing wave ratio bridge, and you'll find out what the antenna is really doing. So if you have any doubt, that's all that matters. If you get a standing wave ratio of 2-to-1 or better on VHF frequencies, that's more than good enough. It doesn't have to be anywhere near as low as it does on a desktop rig on an HF frequency. There, you'd like it to be a 1.5-to-1 or better, because some of those rigs are fairly sensitive to that. VHF rigs are pretty rugged. You could probably put a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio on a VHF rig, and it would keep right on cranking and give you 95% of the performance. When it comes to the routing of the coaxial cable for a mag mount antenna, that's a little bit of an art form. The whole reason why people use a mag mount antenna is so that you can unplug it and put it in the trunk when you're bringing the car to a New York City parking garage, if you know what I mean. You don't want to advertise with the antenna on the roof the fact that there's an expensive radio inside. On top of that, the antenna on the roof is going to be hitting the fluorescent lights as you drive into the parking garage and breaking them and so on. So there are times when you want to remove it. So that's one of the main reasons why a person uses a mag mount. Let me drop. And we all start off in the very beginning by opening the window a little bit and bringing the coax cable into a partially open window. Well, on a rainy day, that's not a good solution, and you're putting a kink in the cable. The next thing you do is to open the door, put the coax cable around the door hinge, and then close the door. Well, you'll soon realize that if you do that in the simple way, you'll end up with some water running into the automobile and getting onto the floor. Finally, you'll discover that routing the coaxial cable from the roof of the car across the first piece of metal of the door mechanism, running it down the side of that mechanism, probably with duct tape, and then bringing it across the rubber that gives you the weather seal of the door. The door closes into the major body of the car by way of a rubber seal. And if the coax cable goes across the rubber seal on the bottom of the door, then the water will tend to drain outward instead of inward. You bring that coax cable across the rubber on the top of the door, it's just a matter of time before you get some water in the car on a rainy day. So properly routing that cable, and then taping it in position, and then bringing it across the rubber seal near the bottom of the door, then under the rug is one of the convenient ways, over to where you operate the handy-talkie. That can make a very neat-looking installation, and yet you're not modifying the automobile in any way. So it's not as difficult as you think, and the performance is a heck of a lot higher. You're going to find people who say that when the antenna doesn't go through a real LMO or whatever it's called, connector that's screwed through the metal of the car, that you're not going to get full performance. Lots of people believe that. It's not true. A properly installed mag mount will give you full performance. KC2WGB, that's a bunch of opinions on my part. Been there, done that. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. I'm sure that'll give Steve, and I hope his dad and mom are listening, so that they can be assured that the car will survive. I have another one here from Leonard in Brooklyn concerning batteries. Well, let me let it drop. He has a device that has a 5.7-volt battery. It's sort of like a coin battery. He cannot find a replacement for it. 5.7 volts. He wants to replace it with a 6-volt regular battery, and he's going to mount it on the outside and bring the wires into that same position. It seems that the holder for the original battery had rotted away, and he can possibly, even if he received the battery, he couldn't get it to mount in there. He'd like to know if that voltage difference is going to make any problem for him. This is only for the memory of this device, so maybe you could speak about battery replacement thing.
Yeah, when it comes to the battery retaining memory standby battery, the memory device battery, many of these integrated circuit chips are very forgiving along those lines. The coin batteries that run around 3 volts, lithium-type coin batteries, are what are frequently used, and my experience has been that you don't lose memory until that coin battery voltage goes down to some very low number, like maybe half a volt or 1 volt. Normal 3-volt battery, until it gets down to a very low voltage, you still have memory. My calculators also have one of those. And even when the battery gets low, you tap into that memory, the response time of the memory gets slower, but it works. So my impression is that it's very forgiving. I'm amazed that 5.7 volts is required. That's a crazy number. Like you said, it must be an older piece of equipment. I doubt that 6.0 volts is going to hurt a 5.7 volt circuit, but I'm not sure. There's a very, very slim possibility that that particular integrated circuit chip memory function has a 5.9 volt not to exceed. There's a slim possibility. I doubt that. If you could look inside and find out the model number of the integrated circuit chip and then find the data sheet on that integrated circuit chip, that would give you the best possible answer. Once you know that the radio itself, I'm assuming it's a scanner radio, has a model number and brand name, and you ask the question on the right website, one of these listservs, guarantee somebody has used that particular radio and can answer the question for you. As you can tell, I doubt it's going to be a problem, but I can't be sure, because I've never heard of that exact number. My gut feel is that...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
My gut feel is that if you plugged in a typical coin battery at 3 volts, you would have the memory function. Because of my experience is that that memory function, as long as there is some fraction of the original voltage there, the reason why they chose 3 volts is because that happens to be the voltage that comes out of a lithium battery, lithium coin battery, and they chose a lithium coin battery because in very low current drain service, which is what that is, that battery has a very long shelf life, at least 7 years used correctly. So So they chose the battery because of the 7-year battery, if you know what I mean. And that the exact voltage is secondary to it. My best recommendation, though, is do a little more research. I mean, if it's not a super expensive radio where if it died, and then